and mysticism has become of considerable importance in Western history ever since the Middle Ages, when the limits of doctrinal expression of truth became visible, especially through the work of Thomas Aquinas. In the generation after Aquinas begins the split in theologizing between nominalism, as represented by Occam, and mysticism, as represented by Eckhart. The two strands of nominalist faith and mystical faith have remained ever since two important strands in Western intellectual history. The nominalism and the nominalist faith in dogma that has separated from experience and can no longer be controlled by recourse to experience has become the publicly dominant form because it was, beginning with the 18th century, adopted as the intellectual form of ideologizing. Mysticism, in this situation, becomes again and again the concern of philosophers when the various doctrinal truths, in the plural, get fighting. In the 16th century, when there were 8 religious civil wars in France, Jean Bodin recognized that the struggle between the various theological truths on the battlefield could be appeased only by understanding their secondary importance in relation to mystical insight. He wanted his sovereign, King of France, to be, if not a mystic, at least to be advised by a mystic like himself, in order to stand above the battlefield of the dogmatomachy. My careful study of the work of Bodin in the early 30s gave me my first full understanding of the function of mysticism in a time of social disorder. I still remember Bodin's letter à Jean Bautru as one of the most important documents that has affected my own thought. In the 20th century, when the dogmatomachy is no longer that of theological sects, but of ideological sects, a similar understanding of the problem has again occurred in the work of Henri Bergson in his De Sources de la Morale et de la Religion. I doubt that Bergson has the same stature as a mystic that has Bodin. Still, these two French spiritualists are for me the representative figures of the understanding of order in times of signal disorder. Regarding the institutional realization of existential order, the American society seems to have certain advantages over other national societies in the Western world. But I must first of all admit that in that matter I am biased, because after all I had to run for my life from the political environment in Central Europe, and I was received with kindness in America. That of course creates a prejudice. Still, I hope that certain observations will not be colored in a prejudicial manner. There is, first of all, the great problem of the Western Revolution. Oswald Spengler already has observed that the revolutions which occurred before 1789, meaning thereby the English and the American Revolution, were of a conservative type, retaining the cultural structure of Western civilization. With the French Revolution, in his opinion, begins a movement of destruction of Western culture. These formulations are somewhat abstract, but they can be elaborated by more concrete observations. Obviously, a revolution like the American is distinguished from a French or a Russian revolution or a German National Socialist revolution by the fact that it was able to create successfully an open society with the minimum of governmental violence required for its imposition. Of the major revolutions, it is, one might say, the only one that has been truly successful. A good deal of continental, French and especially now, German animosity against America, to be found among French and German intellectuals, is, in my opinion, due to the fact that a revolution should not be successful because the intellectuals want to make a revolution of their own, in the tradition of the French destruction of cultural order. The animosity of the French Revolutionary Revolt in the name of reason and the supreme being against the Christian order, not too pleasantly represented in 18th century France by the church and its clergy, has no real parallel in America. As a consequence, we have in this country a society based on a revolutionary tradition, which, however, is not animated by the just intimated French anti-Christian animosity. However, the European influences come again and again, and our intellectuals are strongly influenced by the European and especially the French type of intellectualism, and perhaps even more so now by certain German strands of Hegelianism and Marxism. These trends are in conflict with the American tradition, and a good deal of the contemporary civilizational turmoil and the famous divided society is due to an absorption of the French-German type of the incomplete revolution in opposition to the successful American revolution. That a large sector of American intellectuals is anti-American must be acknowledged, even if they would deny it. It is the same anti-Americanism that is to be found with European intellectuals. This anti-Americanism, setting aside certain hardcore fringe movements, however, is definitely not a serious communism. If for no other reason, because, as far as I know, the most ardent intellectuals, short of a few scholars, are not literate enough to read a thinker of some stature like Marx at all. What we have is not a communist or even a Marxist movement, but a paramarxist bred that always breaks down in practice because the realities which Marx envisaged lie quite beyond the horizon of their understanding. Still, even in this tertiary vulgarian form, such intellectual movements are a disturbing factor in society to such an extent that the language of polarization in society has become quite popular. Considering the structure of American society, I very much doubt that such a polarization has occurred. What really has happened is an inconsiderate and partly illiterate intellectual movement that inadvertently has polarized itself out of the American social reality and now has to pay the price of defeat for this pragmatic inadvertency. Under one aspect, this American polarization out of reality has certain similarities with the parallel European intellectual developments. The famous year 1968, with its riot in Paris, revealed, if anything, the non-existence of a revolutionary situation. Raymond Aron has seen quite rightly what the problem is when he gave his analysis of the phenomenon the title La Révolution Introuvable, making himself quite unpopular by this analysis. That movements of this kind, polarizing themselves out of reality, could arise at all and create considerable public noise is possible only because American society obviously is beset by a number of social problems which require solutions too long delayed. There is the obvious problem of the status of the black population, the identification under American conditions of lower classes with racially and ethnically identifiable groups, so that the inevitable status of lower classes becomes an unpleasant tinge because the lower classes are recognizable as ethnical or racial groups. Then there is the problem of the Vietnam War, or was, whether it was necessary in the national interest to have that war is very much open to question. But once it was started, it had to be carried through to some sort of conclusion, because one cannot simply end the war by walking out of it. Moreover, the conditions of the war against a totalitarian power faced the American government with problems, which it had also to face, of course, in the war against Hitler, but which in the Vietnam War were aggravated by the remoteness of the actual problem from the daily experience of the American people. The problem to which I refer is a war against a totalitarian power if the ruling group of the totalitarian sectarians is firm in its faith and quite willing to sacrifice the people to the bitter end for its domination, can only end with such horrors of physical destruction that the actual conduct of the war comes to a physical end. The same problem arose in Vietnam because the North Vietnamese government did not hesitate for a moment to have the Vietnamese people exposed to the destructions of war, so that from the American side, especially through the TV reportage, the destruction was brought home to the American people as a destruction worked by the American army. That the war has two parties and that the destruction could go on without the other party, who was the military victim of the destruction, giving up, simply was not raised into consciousness. The bombing of German cities into vast fields of rubble and the mass killings of the civilian population, as for instance in the bombardment of Hamburg, where it was estimated in one night the casualties were more than 40,000, was taken with equanimity. Comparable destructions on the minor scale in an underdeveloped country aroused horror. What was disregarded was that these horrors were caused by ideological sectarians and not by the American government. On this occasion, they became visible the enormous power of the mass media under the control of the intellectual establishment. For the historian, it is a fact of first importance in the understanding of certain trends in American society that it was possible to convert the military defeat of the communists in the Tet Offensive of 1968 into an American defeat through the propaganda of the mass media. Similar transformations occurred on occasion of the famous invasion of Cambodia. The fact that Cambodia had been invaded by a communist army from North Vietnam and that a military expedition against an invasion is not in its turn an invasion, a fact that every international lawyer knows, did not deter the intellectuals from falsifying the facts into an American atrocious aggression. Similar minor transformations by the intellectuals occurred in the case of the famous bombing of dikes in North Vietnam, or in the transformations through deliberate lies of the bombing of military targets in Hanoi into a carpet bombing against the civilian population. The examples just enumerated will have to be considered by the historian as a serious problem in the intellectual sector of the American society, indicating their willful separation from reality and the violent aggressiveness in the realization of utopian dreams. Since this intellectual environment is not confined to journalists and TV reporters, but has penetrated deeply into the academic world and through the academic world into the education of the young generation, one must recognize in these trends a danger to democracy, which has to rest on contact with the reality in the population at large.